This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's autumn. The days grow short, the temperature dips, sometimes dives. It's a time of the year when a bowl of soup and a salad are just the thing for supper. And for dessert, a slice of warm apple pie. On the program today, soup for supper, apple pie for dessert, food writer and cooking teacher Ken Heydrich is our guest. Ken Heydrich is the winner of the Julia Child Cookbook Award for his cookbook Home for the Holidays. Heydrich is the author of a total of, I believe, 8 cookbooks, including Soup Makes the Meal and Apple Pie Perfect. In addition to writing cookbooks, Ken Heydrich is a regular contributor to the magazines Better Homes and Gardens and Bon Appetit. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Perhaps you have a tip or a recipe for soup or apple pie you'd like to share. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Ken Heydrich, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, how are you, Celeste?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Well, one of the recipes included in Apple Pie Perfect is from your mom and dad. In fact, your memory of your folks making pie is that it was your dad who was the guy who was sort of in charge of that operation. Maybe you tell us what you remember about the two of them in the kitchen making apple pie.
Well, this is probably my first memory of apple pie. It dates back to when I was just a little kid growing up in Plainfield, New Jersey. And my parents had this great fall weekend ritual. They would go out to their favorite farm stand, and often with at least a few of us, 7 kids in tow. And they'd pick up just bushel baskets full of apples, and they would bring them back, and over the weekend, they would make their apple pies together. And my mom, she was the filling gal, so to speak. And my dad, he was very precise with the pastry. He loved to make the pastry, and I don't think he had a special recipe or anything. I think he just used the one that was on the Crisco can. But I was always so enthralled by watching him roll this out very carefully, and it was a very funny sight because he would put on one of my mom's frilly aprons to do this with, and he had quite the bald spot in his head, and he'd always end up with flour on top of his head. So it was very it was a lot of fun to watch them, and then of course to hover nearby, you know, smelling the pie as it baked, and then sort of pouncing on it as soon as it came out of the oven. Mm. So this is my first memory, and I had the good fortune recently. My mom and dad are both still alive and still living in New Jersey. And you may have noticed I dedicated the book to them because of this, and their wedding pictures in there from the early 1940s. And I had the good fortune of being able to do an apple pie baking demonstration down in their hometown in New Jersey. And they were in attendance, so I had a chance to introduce them to the crowd there at the demonstration.
Mm. What a wonderful family fall ritual.
Yeah, it was great. It really was. And I would hope that everybody this time of year would do something similar to it. I mean, apple pie is such a wonderful thing to bake. There's nobody, in my experience, who doesn't like apple pie. So I would encourage all your listeners to make their favorite pastry and get some great apples and dive in.
Yeah. Now, your mom and dad, what was their pie like?
Well, they had a great brown sugar. In fact, it's in the book in Apple Pie Perfect. I call it my mom and dad's brown sugar apple pie. And it really, like I said, Dad was not one of these people who saved recipes or went out of his way to find a special pastry. So it was a fairly traditional vegetable shortening style crust. And other than that, it was, you know, they didn't believe in mixing other fruits in or things like that. They were sort of apple pie purists.
Yeah.
And they used Macintosh apples. In fact, they had... which I thought was interesting because it wasn't until many years later when I started making them on my own that I bothered to ask them what kind they used. And I was a little bit surprised because there are many people who don't like a Macintosh apple for a pie. A lot of people think it cooks up a little too soft and mushy, more like applesauce. But nonetheless, that's the type that they used. And they sweetened theirs with brown sugar, just a little bit of lemon juice, cinnamon, nutmeg, And it was a double crust pie. They had a top and a bottom crust. They didn't put a crumb crust on top. And it was the best pie in the world. Mm. It was really wonderful.
Do you have a favorite apple when it comes to making apple pie?
Boy, I tell you, Celeste, that is the question I hear more than any other. I give these apple pie baking demonstrations all over the place, and other than the questions that relate directly to making a good pastry, that's the thing that everybody wants to know: what's the best pie apple? And when I started writing Apple Pie Perfect, I had it in my head that there were, quote, good apples and bad apples when it came to making pie. But as I got into it, I found more and more it's not so much a question of good and bad. It's really a question of what's to your taste. Some people like a soft apple, like the Macintosh we were just talking about, and others like a very firm one, like the Northern Spy. So, gosh, I would say Northern Spy is a very, very good one.
Mm-hmm.
It's crisp. It holds its shape. It's got a nice, complex flavor. It's nice and juicy. So that's a good one. A little bit hard to find, though, in some markets.
Yeah.
Granny Smith is another one that I like very much, although I've spoken to people who don't. So, again, it's a very personal thing. Golden Delicious, they're pretty good. If you get them when they're juicy and fresh, they can be a very good pie apple. But the problem with them is they tend to dry out fairly quickly, too. So Northern Spies, Grannies, Goldens, I mean, there are tons of good apples. Jonna Golds are very good. It's a cross between a Golden Delicious and a Jonathan.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, in some pies, you like to use a mixture.
Yeah, I do. And the reason I like to do that is because you get a little bit of the personality of each one. For instance, if you use those Macintoshes, you get a little bit of that sauciness in there. And then if you have a firm apple in there, like the Golden Delicious or the Northern Spy, you get the firmness. And then if you use a very tart, sort of complexly flavored apple like the Granny, then you get that in there too. So it's sort of a fun way to mix up the personality of the pie.
Mm. When did you discover that there were so many ways to make apple pie? I mean, in this one book, you've got 100 apple pie recipes.
I know. It does seem... I defy anybody to come up with more than 100 recipes for apple pie. No, I tell you, I first started making apple pies when I joined the Navy when I was 17, and I often found myself in situations where I was living off base with a bunch of guys, and when you're in that situation, you either do the dishes, you cook, or you clean up, or you buy the beer, or one or the other. And I always just found myself gravitating towards the kitchen, and I guess I had learned my parents' lessons by osmosis, because from the very start, I learned I could make a pretty good apple pie. And not long after I got out of the Navy, I moved up to New England, and I lived in New England for 20 years. And in New England, of course, we have some great apples. And I found myself every year just sort of stretching the boundaries of apple pie and looking for more and more ways to do it. You know, up here, of course, a lot of people in New England bake with maple syrup, so mm-hmm. you find a lot of maple syrup-type apple pies. But you know, there are lots and lots of ways that you can spin this theme. I mean, I love to use different fruits. One of my favorite pies to demonstrate and to bake is one. It's a mixed pie with part apples and part pears, and that's a great pie. And I add a little bit of ginger to that one. It really warms the flavor up nicely. But I don't know. I've just been collecting ideas and sampling pies for years and years and years, and this Apple Pie Perfect is the fruition of it, you might say.
You got a tough job, Ken.
It's tough when you get on the scale. And you see that you've put on 10 more pounds, and it's even tougher when now I'm working on another pie book, 300 pie recipes for all different types of pies. So,
oh, that sounds great.
No end in sight of the pie tasting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's the most unusual recipe you've come across for apple pie?
Well, most unusual... There's one in the Pennsylvania Dutch tradition that I like very much, and I have a I have an example of in an apple pie perfect, and it's an apple pie made with grated apples. And it's not so unusual because it uses apples, but it is in the fact that they're grated. And I like the idea very much. It appealed to me. I can't say exactly what about it appealed to me. It just seemed like a real neat idea, an old-fashioned sort of idea, and it was wonderful. The finished texture of the pie is very saucy because you start with grated apples, and it cooks up like this, just the softest of apple mush in the crusts, and I just love that very much. So that's sort of an unusual one. One of the more unusual ingredients that I like to use in an apple pie is something that's very popular with old-time New Englanders, and it's called boiled cider. And it's just what it sounds like. It's boiled. It's apple cider that's been boiled down to about 1/7 or 1/8 of its original volume. And one of the reasons I love to use it is because it really gives your apple pies a nice apple kick in flavor. And it's particularly nice if you have apples that are a little bit lacking. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. you buy apples and they're just not living up to their promise or what you hope. So adding boiled cider is a nice way to kick up the flavor.
Yeah. Sometimes when I buy apples, I feel like what I'd like to do is buy one of each and go home and try them out and then go back later that same day.
Well, I tell you, in jest, in the book, I talk about picking up apples and biting them and embarrassing my kids in the market. But in fact, it's true. When I go to the market, I pick up an apple. If I have any doubts at all, I'll take a bite of it, and of course I'll put it in my bag. But I can't see paying for apples that aren't good. And if I bite into an apple and it's mealy and it tastes old and it has no juice or nice balance of sweet and tart, I won't buy it. And I don't mean to sound cavalier about it, but you're right. It's a real predicament. You know, we go to the market and it's hard to know exactly which apples are great, because they all look great. They're all nice and shiny and red and attractive, but you really don't know until you bite into it.
Yeah, and I hate that mealy thing. You know, then what do you do with it?
I know. And that's the nice thing about baking an apple pie. An apple pie can hide a lot of sins in your apples. And, you know, that's another reason why, to me, it's always a good bet to buy a few different kinds of apples, because if you buy some and they're not very good, you can always mix those in with the ones that are good or are better. And that's sort of, so you're sort of hedging your bets there by buying a little bit of a variety.
Yeah. And I suppose you can also, you know, if you do get some bad apples, you can do applesauce or apple butter.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. You certainly can.
Yeah. But when it's not good, eaten out of hand, it's so sad.
That's what I like to say. You know, I people often ask me, what's the best apple, like you did a minute ago? And I, first of all, and to the point where it seems to be something that people really worry about, and therefore I sort of go to the extreme in trying to put people at ease, and I say, you know, if it makes a good eating apple, it's probably going to make a pretty good pie apple. And, you know, from there we qualify by saying, you know, some apples are have this to offer and some apples have that to offer, but I always like to put people and home cooks at ease and just say, you know, it's really not that big of a deal. If it's crunchy, if it's sweet, tart, if it's juicy and it has a nice flavor, it's going to make a good pie apple.
Ken Heydrich is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the winner of the Julia Child Cookbook Award. We're talking with him this afternoon right now about apple pie. Also this afternoon, we hope to talk with him about soup. Ken is the author of a number of cookbooks, including Soup Makes the Meal and Apple Pie Perfect. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Perhaps you've got a tip or a recipe you'd like to share. Well, we'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, in addition to that question that you get, what's your favorite apple? I think you mentioned this. The next most often question asked is, What are the basics for a successful pie pastry?
Yeah, it is. And in these two-hour demos that I give a two-hour baking demo, we spend about half the time working on pastry because it really is the thing that gives people the heebie-jeebies. And one of the first things I do is I ask people how many of you make your pastry in the food processor, and I assumed that it was many more people than there actually are who are doing it, and from that point, and it's usually just a handful of people in an audience of 100, you'll just find, you know, maybe 5 or 10 are using their food processors to make their pastry. So it turns out that my favorite pastry in the book, it's called the Best Butter Pastry, is the one that I like to demonstrate at my demonstrations. And it's one of the reasons I like it is very quickly and easily made in the food processor. So anyway, we go through making this nice buttery pastry, and then we get it out onto our work counter. And then the thing I like to tell people is I say, this is probably the single most important thing I'm going to tell you today, is that when you make this pastry or any other pastry, make sure you wrap it up in plastic wrap and refrigerate it for about 45 minutes before you try to roll it. Because inevitably, the questions that I get and the comments that I get with people having dysfunctional relationships with their pastry has to do with the fact that it's sticking. It sticks to the rolling pin. It sticks to the counter. It sticks to the whatever surface they're working on. And I tell people that if you simply take this one step, wrap it in pastry, what you do is you flatten it into a disc about 3/4 of an inch thick. And then you wrap it up in the pastry and just refrigerate it for about 45 minutes. That's just long enough to refirm the butter
uh-huh.
or the fat, and it makes it so much easier to roll out.
Yeah.
So that's trick number one. Trick number two is my favorite surface to roll on is wax paper. It's the most forgiving surface there is, and you can roll it directly onto the wax paper. You give it a little turn as you roll. You sort of push forward and then turn and push and turn, and it doesn't get stuck to the counter. It's simply being rolled out on the paper, and then you can actually invert the paper and the pastry right over your pan and then peel off the paper. So those two tricks, I think, will go a long way in helping your listeners to make a better pastry.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener. A caller in Hammond, Illinois, on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
You guys always get me starving on these shows. I want to bust the vanilla ice cream out. But anyway, I just wanted to, I don't know how to make pies, but I like to eat them. I like the Cortland apple.
Oh, okay.
And, which are really good. And it seems like when you go to the grocery stores, the apples are always kind of bland tasting, so I like the ones from the orchards. You know, they seem to be better.
Yeah, and we have orchards in the area too. That's a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with your caller. I think it's. I mean, I have nothing against grocery stores. Obviously, they're great places to shop. But the most interesting apples, by far, and the freshest ones are always going to come from your local farm, your farm stand. And these are good people. They're local people. They're farmers, and we should support them. So by all means, if you're looking for apples for, our caller wasn't a pie baker, but if his wife or his girlfriend is, that's a great place to start. And it's a great place for a family outing, too, like I was describing in at the outset there, how fun it was when I was a little kid to, for all my brothers and sisters and I to pile in the car and go to the farm stand. So that's where you're going to get your best apples. I agree.
They used to, when I was in high school, they made a Dutch apple pie that had like a cinnamon crispy on top of it.
Yeah.
And it was just out of this world. And the women, if you always wanted another piece, you always go up and they'd give you more, you know. But anyway, that's just all I wanted to say.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener on line 1 on a cell phone. Hello there.
Good morning. Or good afternoon. I have found one of the better apples I found in the stores is one called a Fuji. What can you tell me about the Fuji apple?
Well, It hasn't been around all that long in the American market, but it's one of those apples that is quickly gaining a lot of fans here. The Fuji is a cross between a Red Delicious and something called a Rawls Janet, and it's supposed to be one of the best-selling apples in Japan. I guess it was first bred there in Japan. It's some people don't think it makes a great baking or a pie apple. It's more of what they consider a dessert apple. By dessert apple is one that's best eaten out of hand, but I think it's actually a very excellent pie apple.
I find it very creamy like.
Yes, it's a creamy texture. It's got like a spicy flavor too, that I find very appealing, and it's a very juicy apple. So in that respect, and a nice thing about Fuji's too is they actually the flavor improves with age. Something you may have noticed. I'm with you. I think it makes it's a great eating apple, and I think it makes a great pie too.
Now, on the pie crust thing.
Yeah.
In my refrigerator, I have a marble rolling pin that I roll my pie crust with, and it seems to keep the crust chilled enough that I can handle it a little bit longer.
Yeah, well, that's people like marble for that reason. It does help keep your pastry cool, and therefore you'll have less problems with sticking. I think the most important thing about a rolling pin, however, is the fact that it feels comfortable in your hands. That's really the major consideration if you're getting a new rolling pin or if you're working with a rolling pin. But more power to you if you have a marble one that really works well for you. I think that's great.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a listener on the toll-free line in Belgium. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wanted just to slightly make a variation on your pie theme. Does anybody ever make pear pie? I know that if you let the pears go too far, they'd be far too mushy. But if it was a green pear, would it work as a filling for an apple pie type pie?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned earlier that one of my favorite pies, and one that I often bring to the baking demonstrations that I do, is an apple-pear pie combination, especially this time of year when the pears are so good. Certainly, you could make an all-pear pie, and you could pretty much follow any recipe for the proportions, for an apple pie, apply them to your pears. But I love that combination together, and I particularly love it with a sort of streusel brown sugar butter topping that one of the previous callers was talking about. That's my favorite way to have an apple pear pie.
Now, like I said, do you have to have the pears fairly firm, or would...
Well, I think they don't have to be firm, but they should definitely be ripe, because you know how pears are if they're not ripe. And I don't necessarily mean overripe. I just mean ripe, and they should have a certain amount of sweetness and juiciness to them when they're right at that point. They could be a little past ripe, but not underripe. Underripe pears, they won't make a great pie, but if that's what you have and you have no other options, use a little bit extra sugar and a little bit extra lemon juice.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Go ahead.
Another thing about pears, too, most pears, and this is something I tell people who come to my baking demonstrations, most pears have very soft skins. There are some exceptions, but with pears, I don't even bother to peel them. I just core them. I quarter them and core them and then just slice them right into my pies.
Okay. And this is something that I have learned relatively late in life is in terms of figuring out best you can before biting into a pear when it's ripe or not, a delicate, scent of pearness.
Yes.
And at the top of the pear, a very gentle touch to the top of the pear near the stem.
Mm-hmm.
If it yields a little bit, you're ready to go.
Yeah, you want that with a pear. You want a pear that yields a little bit too fairly firm finger pressure. They're hard. Pears are a little bit tricky to gauge. It seems like in the old days, and remember, maybe I'm just getting too old here, but it seems like in the old days they used to ripen a little more gradually. Now it seems that you buy them in the store, and they're firm as a rock, and you get them home, and about a day and a half later they're ultra soft. So I don't know what's happening with them, whether they're treating them differently these days or what.
Yeah. I want to, before we move on to soup, I want to ask you Another question about pie pastry.
Sure.
What do you think of the crust you can buy frozen or in the refrigerated section of the grocery?
Well, I think better to make some kind of an apple pie with someone else's crust than not to make apple pie at all. And I certainly believe that there are times, there are occasions, and there are people who, for whatever reason, are not going to make a pastry from scratch. Maybe they're cooks who are just too intimidated or don't have the time. And in that case, better to use someone else's frozen crust and to make a homemade filling than not to make pie at all. And is it the same as having a your homemade crust? No, it's not the same. But is it still good? Sure, it makes a very good pie. So if that's what your options look like, then by all means, go ahead. Use a packaged crust, use somebody else's frozen crust, and make a pie.
Yeah. And there's more than one way to make an apple pie. I mean, in the book Apple Pie Perfect, for example, for folks who have crust phobia, you do have recipes that have crumb crusts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. And some of those are crumb crusts that go on. Most of those are crumb crusts that go on top of the pie. So you don't even have to make any pastry at all. You can buy a frozen pastry and use it in the bottom, and then you can put one of those crumb crusts on top.
Yeah, either that or if you can make that one bottom crust, you don't have to worry about what the top looks like because that the crumb is
right.
Always going to look good.
Right, just get that one in the bottom there.
Yeah,
going to see it.
Patch it up if you have to.
Right.
Whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we've put the pie before the soup here today. And I want to move on to soup because
sure.
I'm crazy about soup. I think it is just a wonderful thing, and it's such a great thing to have for dinner. And so often it's so easy to make.
Yeah, it sure is.
I want to talk about, well, since we've been talking about apple pie, let's talk about apple soup. This recipe that you've got in the book, the soup book, Soup Makes the Meal, squash cider and apple soup. Is this as good as it sounds?
Well, it is. In fact, it might be even better than it sounds. Because some people might think that combination doesn't sound particularly good. But this is the sort of thing. I live in Annapolis, Maryland now, but this is the sort of thing that, when you lived in New England as long as I did, that makes perfect sense. I mean, we have, at harvest time in the fall, we have great squash, great cider, great apples. And those flavors, when you're looking at it from the perspective of a New England cook, have a certain harmony to them that really appeals. And what we do with this soup is it starts out like most others with a basic sauté. We sauté some onion in a little butter, and then we add some butternut squash and apples and stock, chicken or vegetable stock. And we cook that down, get it nice and saucy, and then we take and puree that and add some reduced cider. Remember earlier I was talking about reduced cider. Well, this is cider that you reduce on your own. You just put it in a pan in a skillet and boil it down to a fraction of its original volume, and that's what really gives this soup that real apple kicker of a flavor. It's got a little brown sugar in there, too, for sweetness, and a little bit of cinnamon and cloves, and it really is an exquisite soup. I highly recommend it. And for that, you would want a good sweet winter squash. There's one that they grow around here called delicata squash. You may have seen those in the market out there, but it's a very, very sweet flesh squash that tastes excellent in this soup.
Okay, very good. And the recipe in the book, 5 to 6 servings, can you double that, Ken?
Oh, sure, yeah. The soups are so, that's the thing that's so nice about soups. You can double them so easily. They're great for people who like to putter. It's a real putterer's art, this soup making, and it's such a forgiving medium. If a soup recipe says to add, a cup of peas, well, if you like peas, you can add 2 cups of peas, and if you like basil, add, twice as much as they say. That's sort of the all-encompassing, democratic nature of soups that I like so much. It's really one of those things you can tinker and play with and putter away the afternoon. There's nothing better than spending a Saturday afternoon puttering over a pot of soup, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm planning to make this soup this weekend, by the way.
Yeah, great.
And also I want to tell listeners that we'll make this recipe, Ken is going to make this recipe available to us to put on our website at will.uiuc.edu. And if you're not on the web, you can send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll get that recipe out to you. The address is WILL Radio, Afternoon Magazine, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Another listener is waiting to talk with us, a caller in Indianapolis on line 4. Good afternoon. Caller on line 4, I can hear you, I think. Are you there?
Yes, I'm calling from Indianapolis on my cell phone.
Okay, go ahead.
An orchard friend of mine introduced me to the Mutsu apple many years ago, and he passed away, and the orchards were bulldozed, and I've looked for that apple ever since, and I can't find that variety. Can you tell me anything about it?
Well, the Mutsu you may find in the market as a Crispin. It's also known as a Crispin, and it's one of the largest apples you'll probably likely to run across. It looks something like an overgrown Golden Delicious apple, and it, in fact, it's a descendant of the Golden Delicious apple, but the flesh is somewhat firmer and crisper and juicier, It's definitely an apple worth looking for.
Well, it was my favorite at the time, and then when I lost it, I started using the Fuji, and I, as a previous caller said, I really like the Fuji apple.
Yeah, the Fujis are great. The Crispin, even though it's a relative of the Golden Delicious, it doesn't hold its shape quite as well. If you're using them in a pie, it tends to get a little bit softer. But I'd say if you can't find it as a Mutsu, ask around. Maybe you can find it as a Crispin. And again, I would call a local orchardist and someone who grows apples and see what they have to say.
Mutsu apple is a Japanese variety also, isn't it?
As far as I know, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions, comments, ideas for soup, pie? Give us a jingle, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I'm Celeste Quinn, our guest this afternoon, Ken Heydrich. He's the winner of the Julia Child Cookbook Award. He's the author of a number of cookbooks, including Soup Makes the Meal and Apple Pie Perfect. In addition to writing cookbooks and teaching, Ken Heydrich is a regular contributor to Better Homes and Gardens and Bon Appetit. That's, you know, we were talking a moment ago about soup and how much leeway you have in terms of tinkering with it. What I'm wondering, though, is are there some rules of thumb for developing a soup recipe?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, well, let's the one irrevocable law, I guess, or rule has to do with salt. And I know this doesn't entirely answer your question, but just as a cautionary note, and this goes for whether you're inventing a soup recipe of your own or whether you're making one in a book. Almost anything you do to a soup, it can survive, even if it was a little bit indiscriminate. But the one thing that it can't do is survive too much salt if you happen to put too much in. Because if you do, you sort of have to start expanding on it to take away the saltiness. And then, you know, it just turns into you have to start adding things, and you really can't bring a soup back from adding too much salt. So the one rule of thumb I would say is do not add too much salt. What I do is I add the salt to a soup gradually as I'm going along, I use dry fingertips, and I stick them into my salt container. Never measure over the container, because that's one way that you can have accidents that will result in too much salt in the pot. But just use dry fingertips, stick them into your salt container, get out a big pinch, and dump it right in the soup. And that's the most important rule of thumb that I can tell you in terms of making a soup. But other than that, there really are no rules. I mean, I love to go through the refrigerator and, you know, pull out little bits of leftovers and just sort of make a free-form soup. And, you know, if I'm doing something like that, well, I'll almost always start, most soups start with a basic sauté. You know, you put a little butter oil in the pot, and you add your aromatic vegetables, usually onion, celery, carrots, and sauté that mixture gently. And I often like to put the top on the pan at that point to sweat them as much as sauté them. That putting the top on there is just sort of a little extra insurance against burning the onions or getting the onions too dark, because it creates a lot of steam. And from there, you know, once your onion is sautéed, you at that point you have to make decisions. You know, do you have leftover beef in your refrigerator? Well, if so, you're probably going to want to go with some beef stock or beef broth. And if it's chicken, well, you want to go with chicken broth. And then, you know, so you add your meats and your stock and your meat, and then whatever vegetables you have on hand. That's sort of a nice free-form, soup. I mean, you must do that sort of thing, don't you, Celeste?
Yeah, I do.
Poke around the fridge.
Mm-hmm. Or if I'm feeling like soup and I'm at the grocery store, I kind of like to look at, you know, what looks good in the produce department.
Yeah.
And build from there.
That's a great way to do it. One thing I always like to throw in my soups, especially if they're vegetable-y soups, I love greens. I don't know if you like to.
Oh, yeah.
But things like kale, Swiss chard, spinach. Those are some of my favorite things to put in soups.
Yeah, yeah. Often I have found that if you need to come up with soup pretty quickly, some canned stock will help. And I really like the reduced sodium broths, although I wish they would do a even further reduced sodium broth.
I tell you, in a perfect world, Celeste, we would all have the time to make stuff from scratch. I mean, it would really be nice if we could our employers gave us a Wednesday afternoon off, go home early and make soup stock from scratch. But of course, we don't live in that perfect world. We live in a world where we often have to make little compromises here and there, and when we do, we rely on canned broth or bouillon cubes or the Swanson broth that comes in the little aseptic boxes, and those products are perfectly fine. I have no problems with that. And soup makes the meal. I give a fair amount of detail about how to make different stocks, but I also don't feel like we should limit our options, because we're busy. We're all busy people, and we need to be able to make soup and not have it depend on whether or not we have fresh homemade stock around.
Mm. What soup ingredients would you suggest we have on hand in the pantry?
Well, definitely whatever sort of stock you're going to be using, a broth, keep it, in cans or bouillon cubes. So that would be in the larder. I would say celery and onions. You know, you're always going to want celery, onion, carrots around. Those are pretty common. Most of us do keep those in the fridge. Canned tomatoes. You definitely want to keep canned tomatoes around, because I'd say 50% of the soups we make, it seems like, has some form of tomato in them, or tomato paste. So those are good things to keep around. Of course, pasta is a nice.
Mm-hmm.
Nice starch to add to soups, and often one thing to remember about pasta is normally you don't, if it's not already cooked, cook it on the side. Don't try to cook it in the soup, because it'll absorb too much of the liquid, unless you're adding just a very, very little bit of pasta. So pasta for sure, and those basic ingredients, you can go quite far if you keep those on hand.
Yeah, some dried beans, canned beans.
Oh, very good. And canned beans, too, because it's much easier to make soup on the spur of the moment if we have a can of garbanzo beans in the pantry, rather than having to cook them from scratch, which takes 3 or 4 hours from the time you start soaking them. So definitely canned beans, yep.
Yeah. And in, as far as the canned beans go, in some soups that my husband and I make, we like to heat them separately, too, because if you're going to have liquid left over, soup left over, you might want to, as far as canned beans go, you might want to have that sort of to the side so that in a reheating operation, you don't
right.
get mushy beans.
Right. Another thing, too, to think about with beans, canned garbanzo beans are, the quality is usually very good. There are some where the quality is not quite so good, but in any event, make sure you always rinse your beans because they tend to have a bit of a film on them.
That's slimy.
Sometimes they can be a little bit salty, so do give them a nice rinse. I just throw them right in my little strainer and rinse them right under running water in the sink.
Yeah. One of my favorite flavors, and you have this flavor in sprinkled nicely through Apple Pie Perfect and Soup Makes the Meal, pumpkin.
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 Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I love pumpkin, and I have another great soup on page 145 of Soup Makes the Meal. It's a curried pumpkin and cheddar bisque, and it's the flavors there really, really work well. It's instead of butter, I use olive oil to saute the ingredients, and I saute the onion and celery and peppers in that. And it gets some chicken stock, it's garlic, it's got some garlic chicken stock, and corn kernels. And then it uses canned pumpkin, the pumpkin puree from the can, so you're not usually using fresh pumpkin here. And then the finishing touch is the cheddar cheese, which you can stir right in at the end or use for garnish. And that's it's a great soup. I love that
yeah.
soup.
Canned pumpkin, that's another great thing to have on hand. It
yes,
works.
That's right. I should have said that earlier.
Yeah. Well, we can't think of everything.
right.
We've got to wrap it up here pretty quickly.
Okay, sure.
In Soup Makes the Meal, there are soup recipes, obviously. But there's also salad recipes and bread recipes. When you build a meal around soup, how do you decide what else might go on the menu? You know, what kinds of things do you take into account?
Well, that's a good question. Because when you do, and I should say that all of the recipes, all of the soups in Soup Makes the Meal, they're part of a soup menu. There are 50 soup menus in this book, and with each of the menus, there's also a salad and a bread. And I've always loved this combination of soup, salad, bread. It has such a nice symmetry to it. But to get to your question about what sort of things to take into consideration, well, you have to decide whether your soup, and in most cases it will be, the soup is sort of the star attraction. But sometimes the bread can be too. But let's just assume for now that the soup is your star attraction, and you want to serve a creamy, sort of heavy-bodied soup, like a broccoli cheese soup or a cauliflower cheese soup. I have variations of both of those, and Soup Makes the Meal. Well, one thing you would want to consider is the fact that with a nice, heavy-bodied, creamy soup like that, you probably wouldn't want to serve a creamy coleslaw because it's too much a repetition of the creamy theme. So if you're going to serve a rich, creamy, hot soup, you probably want to go with a more bracing, refreshing sort of vinaigrette-type dressing on a salad.
Nice, crunchy ingredients
crunchy.
In the salad.
Think of the
sure.
contrast in texture,
uh-huh.
too, like you're talking about, you know, smooth with crunchy. And then the bread, the bread you have a lot of flexibility with on the menu that we were just talking about. And the bread could be a nice fluffy buttermilk biscuit or something like that. Another consideration, of course, is stay as seasonal as possible. I mean, you wouldn't want to make soup that relied on good fresh juicy tomatoes. You wouldn't want to make that in the middle of winter. You wouldn't want to make the soup like that mm-hmm. in the summertime, and maybe serve that with like a blueberry scone or something. But you know what I'm getting at here is just
mm-hmm.
stay as seasonal as you possibly can, and and don't use a little caution when you're doing your textures and things like that. Like we talked about earlier, don't repeat the creamy theme or anything like that.
Okay, we have to leave it there. I've had a great time, Ken.
Oh, this has been fun. I appreciate you calling me, and it's been great to talk to you and to your listeners.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
Okay.
Have a great fall.
Okay.
And happy pie baking.
All right. Thank you.
Ken Heydrich has been our guest here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, the author of a number of cookbooks, including Apple Pie Perfect and Soup Makes the Meal. Listeners, we'll put a couple of Ken's recipes up on our website for you, the website address, WILL.UIUC.EDU. If you are not someone who's on the computer, you don't have the computer, well, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Afternoon Magazine, WILL, Urbana, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And by the way, Soup Makes the Meal and Apple Pie Perfect are available in paperback editions from the Harvard Common Press.